Africa, shed no tears. Mama Africa, the dawn is near. If there is a way, we will find that way.
Welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today. You probably had a cup of coffee this morning, and today we are featuring a new cafe out in Vaudreuil, run by some friends of mine. And we're also, in the second half hour, going to hear a presentation from Fairtrade by Peter Kettler, who is the global coffee manager for the organization Fairtrade. Because a lot of people, I think, are confused about what is the point of fair trade coffee. Why is fair trade coffee any different than regular coffee? So we're going to solve that issue for you today and hear from a couple that run a cafe that only features fair trade coffee, and also from an organization that works directly in the fair trade movement. So Carl Millier and Lise Amar-Cerquera recently opened a cafe in Vaudreuil called Nora Café de Lance, and you can find out more about them. They're actually pictured right on the first page of their website, and their website is lecafenora.com. So that's Le Café, and Nora is spelled N-O-R-A-H.com. And they're at 132 Chemin de Lance in Vaudreuil, Dorion. And they're also on Instagram, so you can check them out on Instagram. And they're right beside a boutique called Pure Art Boutique, which is a fair trade boutique, a boutique that is dedicated to fair trade, which is, you know, kind of the theme of today's show. And this is Ryan Young with Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And I'm here with Lise Amar-Cerquera and Carl Millier. And they are the co-owners and co-founders of the wonderful Café Nora de Lance, which is in Vaudreuil. And it's basically a cafe that goes by the motto of slow food and has a lot of organic products, a lot of local products. And I thought it'd be nice to interview them. How are you doing today, Carl?
I'm very good. Thank you.
And how are you doing today, Lise?
Good.
So how did this happen, opening this cafe?
How did this happen? It's I guess, a family history in some ways, because me and Lise and I, we really love to hang around in cafes and restaurants, and wherever we travel, we would look for places to have a cafe and meet the people and stuff. So I guess it was in the back of our mind. And when we had this opportunity with this place and the house where the cafe is located, I think we just took the chance and we decided that it was an opportunity we could not let go.
I had a background a bit in the food industry too. I worked at Co-op du Grand-Homme in St. Anne's and at Beau's and Furley and a few other places. So I always liked cooking, and, you know, the service industry was always kind of a side job. And we both worked as wildlife biologists before with birds, and that's kind of how we got the opportunity. The owners of the building here are the owners of Pure Art, a fair trade store and charity. And they moved into this big house on Chemin de Lance and asked us if we were interested in maybe opening up a coffee shop. And we met them through our working with the birds. We used to do a bird show in Park Omega with Birds of Prey, a free-flying bird show. And they would come with their five young boys and really loved the birds. And so we got to know them around 16, 17 years ago. And then over time, Carl developed a friendship with Robert, the owner, and we've known them over the years. And then they asked us if we would be interested in opening up a cafe in the building. And it's beautiful by the water, and yeah.
And so what do you look for when you are sourcing products for the store, for the cafe?
Well, fair trade for sure. And then organic, local. We like to get even kind of some wild edibles, a lot of indigenous products too. There's a few indigenous tea company that we like. And we just by chance met this really cool owners of our roaster.
Because even though we want to go to have local product or as much as we can, there's coffee comes from all around the world. So we need to have a compromise on everything that comes in the cafe. There's always a reasoning behind. Is it from Vaudreuil or Hudson? Is it Quebec? Is it Canada? But the coffee we use, it's a coffee roaster that we've been told about that because they were organic and fair trade. And they're located in Ontario. So we got in touch with them and we met them and they could not believe that we wanted to open a cafe right here on this house on Chemin de Lance. And they kind of insist like a few times, are you sure this house, the big house right there? I say, yes, this house, what's so special about it? And then they told us they live pretty much, you know, their backyard is on the cafe's property. So their name is Carl and Nancy, super nice people. And their company name is Totem. And they really emphasize on organic fair trade or packaging is compostable. And so that was exactly in
and
the...
bird. And just by chance, they're bird friendly. They do fundraisers for Le Nichoir and UCROP. And UCROP is a Union Québécoise...
De réhabilitation des oiseaux de proie.
Which is in St. Hyacinthe?
Yes. Yeah. That's a little hospital, bird of prey hospital.
For our bird. Like, we've used the veterinary services often for our birds when they're sick because it's like in North America, one of the only veterinary school hospitals that specializes with birds of prey. So we're like, oh wow, it's really like the full deal. Even one of the coffees is like Femenino. So
Smithsonian bird sanctuary certified. So that was exactly in the line of product.
And it tastes good.
And it's not only because it's certified, but the taste and their professionalism. They have a little shop where they do the roasting and such small equipment, but top notch with computers, and they make sure they get the best flavors and the best roasting for each grain. So they live so close that they come, we order online, and they deliver, come here to their backyard, and we chat with them, we talk, and so that's a good relation, business relation with a local person in Vaudreuil. Yeah.
Nice. Now, just so our listeners understand, because you talk about birds of prey, tell me a little bit about your former business, which was Falcon Environmental Services, and then also how the cafe got its name, because it's called Cafe Nora, right?
Well, like Lise said before, we both studied in biology McDonald campus in St. Anne. And when I graduated, basically the project I was already starting while I was studying is I was basically volunteering at the Raptor Research Center. And I did meet a person who was training falcons. And I was so impressed and amazed by what you can do. And I could not believe it. You could train and let the falcon go and come back. So before classes and after classes, I would go with him, train a few falcons and stuff. So I got really hooked up on the idea of having this relation with a wild animal, because even though they're trained, they always stay, they keep their wild spirit. So when I finished my degree, this person, Mark, Adam, and I, we started a pilot project with the airport of Montreal to provide a service to make sure that there's no, I would say, nuisance birds, but mainly seagulls and pigeons and crows and on the runways, because they make collisions with aircraft and they damage the engine and the cockpit and everything. So the airport are looking, for security reasons, a team to make sure the runways are clear. So we suggested the idea of birds of prey. We started a pilot project, and basically when I finished my degree in biology, I started the pilot project. And from that project, it made the company, like, still exists today for 25 years, providing wildlife control services for airports, military bases, Canada and U.S. We are in New York City, California, Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto. So that's the core of the company. But we also had an education program, which is where I met Liz through this this program or the contract that we had. And Nora is one of the American kestrel that was trained for presentation.
She was like my first bird, really, that I trained for Parco Omega. We got her from the Raptor Center in like 2004, I guess. And so it was my first experience really training a young bird. And it was like amazing experience to live with. And American kestrels are pretty small, around the size of a robin, but maybe wingspan of a crow kind of size. So, but they're a little falcon, the smallest falcon in North America. I trained Nora, and that's kind of, I think Robert and Bridget, when they would come with their kids, the owners of Pure Art, Robert and Bridget, when they would come with their kids, they met Nora as well. And it was just, she was maybe one of the first kestrels we really trained. Before, Carl said they would just kind of show kestrels, but they wouldn't fly them. But, you know, I trained her to allure, and she would kind of do stoops and everything. And she was a really feisty little bird, a lot of personality, and it really got other people interested in training kestrels too. And we just figured that's kind of how I met Carl. That's how we met the McKinnons, who own Pure Art. And it's kind of a good way to educate people about birds of prey too, to name the cafe after her.
So, and you have nice like paintings or drawings of birds of prey in the cafe.
Yeah, exactly. So it kind of gives people an idea of the birds of prey that we have in Quebec. Carl happened to have a friend, Ghislain Caron, who's a wildlife artist who did our logo and who has some of his paintings are in the cafe as well. That Carl knew him a long time ago, and he bought some of his paintings. Yeah, exactly. So we put them up. They kind of fit perfectly in the cafe. And yeah, good way to educate people on even, you know, how pesticides affect birds and habitat destruction. And people are often like, oh, what's this bird on the cups or on our credit card machine kind of thing. And kind of, so we can kind of talk about them more and get people.
In some way, it's like our little educational program on birds of prey. So it's our passion. And when people see an image of the kestrel, you say, oh, what's that bird? So we explained that's a falcon. That's the smallest falcon that lives around here. And you can find kestrels in Vaudreuil and Hudson and the area. And they just, wow, I didn't know that. So it's kind of a good way to explain people that, you know, falcons, they live around us, you know. So that's, like we say, we love to say that it's the logo and the little stamp we put on the cups and the little credit card machine, there's the image. As soon as they pay, they say, oh, what's that bird? You know, there's the little image of Nora. So we explain. So that's, we love to say it's a little educational program because people ask questions about birds.
Nice, nice. And if someone was to come and eat here, because you're open mostly for the lunch time, and so what would, if someone came here, what kind of a lunch could they have?
So we have sandwiches, salad, soups. I try to get, you know, local organic vegetables from like Les Jardins Caria, Meadowlark Rice Farm, Verger Hudson. We get apples from whoever we can, kind of. Right now, we're springtime, a little less choices, but we make everything in-house. We get organic sourdough bread from Furley, and they use Moulin Les Cèdres, or I guess it's called agrobio now, local organic flour in their sourdough bread. And we get a local gluten-free bread too from Wheatless Wonder or Merveille Sans Gluten. And we try to accommodate, you know, vegan, gluten-free, dairy-free kind of options too. And we make a few desserts, different cakes and scones and cookies.
Soups, grill sandwiches mainly. Yeah. That's the... Yeah. The main lunch that we offer is actually one or two soups a day and grilled sandwiches. So it could be as simple as a grilled cheese to a BLT or a turkey cheddar sandwiches and a salad. So very simple, because the concept or the idea of the cafe is the kitchen is behind the counter. So there's no other kitchen elsewhere. So we don't go in very complicated lunch and stuff. So as much as We want to grow. We limit ourselves to what we can do behind the counter, space-wise and everything. So we kind of want to keep it simple for us to being not too complicated to manage and everything, and offer like good quality ingredients and simple food. And people seem to like this idea of even seeing us behind the counter, like Lee's preparing the sandwiches, and I'm mainly making the cafes and the lattes and everything. So people, they order, they see what we're doing. There's no hidden kitchen anywhere. And I think it brings a sense of, I wouldn't say a family, community, and
it's kind of, or, yeah. And we also get, you know, les fermes baleines, local meat, rotten eggs from them, and like ham and the turkeys from them. And
we list the food providers on behind the menu, all the list of where the foods come from. And we see people reading it and they say, oh, that's interesting. You know, the maraîcher, the vegetable comes from there. The cafe, we put the name, Totem Cafe from Vaudreuil. So that's, I think it makes, you know, when you eat something, it's important to know where the food comes from. And we give our money, that people give us money, and we give it to the community, to businesses around the area. So that's a direct relationship that we have with the food we eat, where we buy. And it's for now, it's Lise and I that works at the cafe, but it's all if we have some help from, it could be our kids, it could be a client that's good with barista, comes from lunchtime, they help us. So that's the philosophy a bit of the cafe, you know, keep it small, keep it local.
Because I think as biologists before, that it's kind of hard to make an impact on the community too. Environmental, ecological issues have always been important to us. Well, to me, since I was like 8, you know, and on kind of thing. You know, birds and scout girl guides and all of that kind of thing. And then studying wildlife biology. But when you're working in the field, you don't really feel like you're making an impact. But it seems like a cafe, even before when I worked at the co-op, you feel like you are kind of making more of an impact person to person, just making them think about, you know, slow food movement, taking time to eat well. And like, it may sometimes be more expensive, but we're giving back to the community with like local farms and local artisanal bakery and all of that kind of thing. And kind of teaching them a little about birds too at the same time.
And you have a sign that says slow food. I mean, it's not like a sign advertising anything, but...
Right. Yeah, exactly. The slow food movement is all about that, keeping heritage, you know, seeds and heirloom vegetables to local food, keeping it going, because a lot of it is being lost, kind of, especially with big grocery stores and just one kind of tomato or one kind of, you know, beet or whatever. So we try and get from... Even I went to school with Ferme Tournesol in Les Cèdres, and so we sometimes, try and get stuff from them as well. And we'll get local flowers from one of their farmers for our bouquets.
And you're growing some of your own vegetables in the growing season in your own little garden here at the cafe, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. So we can get, you know, herbs, and even we like to have some wildlife-friendly flowers too, you know, black-eyed Susans and bee balm and...
Edible flowers that you add on the cakes and the pastries.
Yeah. Right now it's just restarting. In the fall and the winter has been a lot of like, you know, beets and greens and stuff. But as it gets nicer, we like to garden too, and like the ideas of permaculture and all that. So, yeah.
And slow food is the complete opposite of fast food, really, in terms of where the food's from. And when people come here, we may be super busy, so people may wait a little bit. And in our mind, you know, we do the best we can. We try to obviously not have people wait for too long, but we can go as fast as both of us can go. And people see us, like, we're not doing nothing behind the counter. So, and where there's customers, because some people, this is their first time, they come here, and it happens a few times, like, it's kind of long, you know, when is it? And in our mind, you know, we do respect their opinion, and we explain, like, we do the best we can, but we're sorry it takes long, but that's the idea of the slow food is take your time, enjoy, and the place is nice, talk with your friends. That's the slow food thing.
You know, especially when you're accommodating to, let's say, vegetarian or vegan or gluten-free, you can't prep that many sandwiches ahead. I'll prep a few maybe, but if they ask for like no this or no that, which we try to accommodate people, and everyone has all kinds of allergies now, which is also related to our agricultural industry and our soil having a lack of minerals, and everyone is reacting to food now, which we totally get and try to accommodate. But then obviously that's going to take a little longer too, if you have to make it specific to what they want.
And we create a clientele that goes with this philosophy, because if people come and they find it too long, well, just don't come back, you know? We want to, that's as simple as that, you know? Yes, in terms of business, you don't want to lose a client, but in some way, we're not a big business. We have no plans of getting so much bigger. And if you find it too long for you, well, maybe try another restaurant. There's tons of other places in Vaudreuil, and go there. But we see that people come and they know the place, they respect that. And more people, they don't expect to have their sandwich within 5 minutes that they paid and placed their order. It may take 15 minutes and so, and they're okay with that. That's what we kind of see in the clients that are new. People come back, they respect that, and we say, sorry, we're a bit long. First thing they say often is, don't worry about it. I'm fine with that. I enjoy the place, and take your time. So that's the idea
and
behind that.
We don't mind if people take their time too and decide to study or work a little bit. It's, you know, I kind of like that aspect of the coffee shop. It's a community space, which we're lacking more and more now. You know, I guess there used to be churches and libraries are the only like free spaces where people can kind of gather. But that's another part of it, is just to have a space that people can come, you know, of all different accessibility for, and if they want to stay for a while, that's cool.
And of course, Carl, you did some of the renovations to create the space. Was there anything interesting when you were doing all that, or when you were decorating?
At first it was only going to be just like a little counter, and then we destroyed two walls to make it a bigger space. And he happened to have a friend who's a filmmaker who's in his off time, who came to help him. So, you know, put in all the flooring, and they made the counter themselves, kind of found, recycled some aspect like the doors and stuff to add to
the cafe. We try to have a design to start with, but we evolved so much from this tiny space to let's put down a wall and then reevaluate, and let's put down the other wall and make it a wider space, and convince the owner of the building that it was we should destroy the conference room. But in the end, you know, it really was a work in progress. And as we evolve and make the counter and even the colors, we were not sure about the paint. So we really work with what we could find and how we see the place. And I would invite friends, we would paint the counter green at some point. What do you think, you know? It's, so we didn't have a fixed plan on the design, but we certainly had an idea of how we wanted to feel in the ambiance, the place. So a lot of green plants. We made it all white with touch of wood, and we found was basically used materials, the chairs from a tavern in Mirabel, the table base was from a restaurant in Pointe-Claire. So we really found things here and there, and it defines more of the look that as we were going, we could see like, okay, this. And it's often only by chance. Like we find, oh, this is not cheap. Let's try it. Oh, let's do it that way. So it was a work in progress, and it ended up like, I think we all agree it's nice, and
it was just basically
it's,
like
it's beautiful.
The coffee machine that we got, which with the help of Totem, since they helped us get in the coffee machine, and the lights are a Montreal company, Hamster, that they make all their lights in Montreal. So that was our two main new things, but everything else was all upcycled and from places around Marketplace.
And what are your hours?
Right now for spring, 10 to 5, Wednesday to Saturday. kind of another part. People would really like us to open more, but I think in a way we're almost teaching people to slow down and make time for family and stuff. So we'll probably, maybe we'll extend our hours a little bit in the summer, but we'll probably still keep the Wednesday to Saturday. Since we cook a lot, almost everything here too, we need the time to prep and to have time to even fix the garden up and do all kinds of other little projects with the kids and other have other interests too. So just keeping it simple. But yeah, Wednesday to Saturday.
We need a 3 days off. Having worked in other business, working too much, I think the 3 days, and we hear about it sometimes in the other businesses and stuff, like working four-day work week and 3 days off. And it makes a lot of sense because you need a day at home just
even for the kids in school. It would be great if it was 4 days. They find it long. You know, it's long to be working really hard, long hours every day, 5 days a week.
Yeah, so we really want to stick to the 3 days off and to avoid, not close, but I mean, having long weekends and only open 4 days, is we would need to hire other person. Not that we don't want to, and we do have some people helping us in the busy lunchtime and stuff. We have help. We want to keep it between us, and we need these 3 days and 4 days. And people know, it's like when you, people come and they know they open on Wednesday. Well, they show up on Wednesday, and it's our busiest day. It's Wednesday because it's, we have the feeling that they're so happy we're open. So it makes a sense of...
need their caffeine.
But a sense of, we don't want to miss it. It's open now. Let's go, you know? So that's another, instead of being open 7 days a week, longer hours where you spread the clientele. If and people want to come, they'll come in the...
Yeah, and I think after the pandemic, the service industry has really seen a change. It's hard to find help. It's such long hours up, just working nonstop, and it's not always sustainable. It's hard, especially if you're using all these local ingredients and stuff. It's really hard to make a profit, and the service industry is really going through a change right now. You see in Montreal and all over the world that they want it to be a healthy work environment too for their employees, and so it seems like keeping it small and just slowly, gradually growing is like the way to go.
That's great. And so my last question is, talk a little bit about the setting, where we are on this road, Chemin de Lens.
Yeah. Well, 132 Chemin de Lens, that's kind of, we called it Nora Café de Lens, since it's on this, Lens is like a shallow bay in French.
It's a shallow bay, yeah.
Yeah, and it's this old house. I forget the exact, do you remember the...
Well, the house that we see today is not the original house. You know, the original house is probably in the 1800s, a small square, but it's been expanded in the 70s with this high roof and the look that it has today. So people think it's a very old historical house, but in fact, it's not the look that it has. It's not that old, but it does look like a museum, or, you know, when you go on Chemin de Lens, I think everybody that drive by, they know this house. We're beside Félix Leclerc City Park. And Chemin de Lens, it's a panoramic road. So it's known because the speed limit is like 40. There's a lot of little farms. Félix Leclerc, which is a Quebec singer, well known in the 70s, 60s.
He may have even lived here, I think, at one point.
Yeah,
he did.
Yeah.
There's
house.
The house, but we heard from clients that knows the history of the area and everything. They say Félix lived in the attic. He rented the attic. I don't know how long he stayed, but he lived here, and then he bought the house, which is maybe four or five houses from where we are now.
And it's kind of cool because it's like we're not far from the Costco and every like downtown Vaudreuil, but you just turn and we're almost right as soon as you turn down Chemin de Lens, it becomes like the country. So it's a pretty, like, people are like, whoa, and I can have a coffee in like the country, even though it's right off of Vaudreuil, not far from, you know, the 40.
And maybe popular with cyclists.
Yeah,
with the park. The cycling path goes to the park, which is Félix Leclerc Park. And the...
Windsurfers and kite surfers, too.
So, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for
Merci,
talking
Ryan.
To us. Yeah.
Merci beaucoup.
And that was an interview with Carl Millier and Lise Amor-Sequeira, who are the owners of Nora Café de Lens, which is located in Vaudreuil-Dorion at 132 Chemin de Lens. And you can check out their website at Le Café Nora. And Nora is NORAH.com. So LeCaféNora.com. And so, yeah, so it's an awesome cafe. I highly recommend it. I don't drink coffee, but, you know, people I know say it's some of the best coffee they've ever drank. And I love to eat their sandwiches and their salads. It's a great spot. And as the warmer weather comes, they're going to have outdoor seating as well. So you are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And now we are going to feature a talk about fair trade from somebody who works for the organization Fair Trade. He's the global coffee manager for Fair Trade, and his name is Peter Kettler. And recently he did an online presentation about the future of fair trade. So here is that presentation now.
What I'd like to do today is sort of talk about the infrastructure of fair trade, who we are, what we do, how we do it, and how we're evolving and changing to meet the evolving challenges that smallholder producers are facing in various parts of, around the world. So what is fair trade? I think it's fair to say that most consumers are familiar with fair trade through the products that we certify, such as bananas, tea, cocoa, flowers, coffee, and many others. But the fair trade movement at its core is basically about people and not products. We're the only certification that guarantees a minimum price and the only certification that is 50% wholly owned and governed by the producers themselves. I guess the good way to think about it is that we operate as a community of shared values that are based upon a set of standards and practices that we have collaboratively agreed upon and are regularly audited by our independent third-party certifying agency, FlowCert. Another notable difference is that Fairtrade only works with cooperatives that are democratically run and have demonstrated that all members have a voice in decision-making. We don't work with large farms or plantations. We really believe that cooperatives and small producer organizations are the entity's best place to meet members' needs. So that's why we work with cooperatives. We also provide a series of programs and projects that help to increase the capacity of producer groups to meet the challenges, which are many, of being a smallholder farmer in the 21st century. And while coffee farming, I think we all realize, has never been easy, producers today are facing a set of unique and unprecedented challenges that are really causing the current as well as the next generation of farmers to question whether coffee farming is even a viable means of achieving a decent standard of living for themselves and their families. So fair trade is an integrated network of producers who are linked to regional cooperatives, who in turn are linked to one of our producer networks in either Latin America, Africa, or the Asian Pacific regions. And the figures here, I think, speak for themselves, so I won't go into any further detail, other than mentioning that nearly half of the farmers within the fair trade system are coffee farmers. We currently source coffee from 635 cooperatives in 34 different countries. And the fair trade premium, as you can see in the lower right-hand corner there, generates more than 85 million pounds per year directly back into those producer organizations. So fair trade is much more than just the fair trade minimum price. Although I think it's fair to say that when most people think of fair trade, they do think of the fair trade minimum price. But the reach of fair trade extends much further than that. In addition to the fair trade minimum price, buyers also contribute another 20 cents per pound in the form of what we call the fair trade premium. And this provides these farmer-led cooperatives with the necessary additional resources to build infrastructure, undertake farm renovations, provide agricultural training, or eventually to increase their capacity to weather the next storm, and be that natural or an economic storm. We also run a number of continuing education programs, including the Fairtrade Climate Academy, that's designed to help producers adapt to the accelerating effects of climate change that we are all seeing in the world around us, and regular workshops on everything from price risk management strategy to quality improvement techniques. After we established the Fairtrade minimum price many years ago, which was designed to be a safety net for farmers to help them meet the cost of production, we realized that this Fairtrade minimum price really wasn't enough to provide them with the necessary scaffolding to ensure that they had the capacity to meet those challenges that they were encountering and still to come. So then we established the Fair Trade Premium, which provides the resources needed to build really truly healthy, resilient small producer organizations, or as we call them, SPOs. And each SPO collectively decides how to invest the premium, and according to their own needs and their own priorities. And this is, again, democratically voted on. And I think, finally, Fairtrade acts as an advocate for trade justice and reform, both in the commercial and the public arenas. And we advocate on a continuous basis for policies in both the public and private procurement that can ensure the most vulnerable links in the supply chains are part of the equitable value distribution within that supply chain. So how do we work with farmers as they continue to face multiple crises? And here we're just listing three crises. I could list probably another three, even nine, even 12. As we know, both price volatility and climate have been continuing challenges for the last several years. And this past year, all of that was compounded by the additional challenges presented by COVID-19, which, as we all know, has affected the entire coffee industry and the entire planet. We still don't know to what extent, long-term extent, that the impacts of COVID are going to have on producer communities. So when we look at price, as we all know, the price of coffee changes every 3 to 5 minutes, and sometimes more frequently than that. We've been having this long-term price crisis over the last few years, which we've seen an uptick recently, but you know, the long-term trend is probably not going to increase the price substantially. And what this does is that it puts farmers in this continual kind of cycle of poverty, and it prevents them from investing in their farm renovations. They can't hire the necessary help, and this results in lower quality and, as an offshoot, increased child labor. The Fairtrade minimum price, as I said before, was designed as a safety net. And again, that fair trade premium, which is another 20 cents, is provided to the cooperative so that they can make those necessary investments. Now, COVID-19, at the producer level, a lot of internal travel was restricted. So either farmers couldn't get to their fields, or they couldn't hire the necessary temporary labor to help with harvest. This fortunately led to some community action in some countries, like Colombia, where the local community came together and actually helped coffee farmers harvest. But it's also led to a shortage of shipping containers. So even if coffee was harvested, many times it would sit on docks and not have a way to make it onto a ship and to a consuming country. COVID-19 also presented increased health and safety risks to producers. Because they couldn't get to doctors, there isn't the kind of infrastructure there in terms of health clinics and facilities to help to deal with not only the impacts of COVID, but just routine health concerns. And it also greatly increased the impact of food insecurity. Additionally, schools were closed. And so, as I said, farmers would oftentimes engage their children in labor because the temporary labor wasn't available. And so all of this resulted in a Fair Trade Producer Relief and Resilience Fund, which we put together with a group of partners. And we quickly distributed over 15 million euros to producer groups, again, to have them decide how to distribute it to meet their local needs. Many times this was put into the form of food packets, additional payments to farmers, or to help with logistical needs. And I think that this is really one of the real true powers of fair trade, is its connected, integrated network that allows us to quickly move either knowledge, resources, or supplies through to some of the most remote producing regions. Climate, I don't need to really go into too much here. I think that probably one of the most alarming statistics that came out recently from both World Coffee Research and Kew Gardens was that it's projected that by 2050, 50% of the current land that is under cultivation for coffee will no longer be suitable for coffee cultivation. What does that mean? It means either lower quality of coffee, increased reliance on Robusta coffees, and of course for producers themselves, it presents additional logistical challenges, and it means that they have to increase their crop diversification, and it really presents these threats to the security and livelihoods of not only producers, but producer communities that are really reliant on coffee production. And so again, what we're doing is providing disaster relief to recent hurricanes like in Honduras and in Nicaragua. We have targeted programs and climate academies that help farmers to meet the numerous challenges that climate change is presenting. And we are continuing to do advocacy at the national and international level around providing producer groups with really a firm footing to be able to meet these challenges that climate change are presenting. So later this year, Fair Trade is going to be publishing our new global strategy, and it's the result of an 18-month process that included multiple consultations with all the stakeholder groups within the Fair Trade system, as well as numerous commercial partners and many government agencies. The main pillars of this strategy are what you can see illustrated here. And following this, each product category and thematic area developed their own 5-year strategy that is in alignment with what was identified as the most important elements of the global strategy, which again is aligned with our theory of change and with the sustainable development goals. The coffee strategy was developed over the last 10 months through a series of, again, consultations with, and maybe some of you were part of our consultations with the commercial sector. We interviewed roasters, retailers, and traders in the EU, Asia Pacific, and North America to really take the pulse of what they're thinking about sustainability in this changing landscape, what their strategy is, and how fair trade can be supportive of those goals. And we also did internal consultations and focus groups with producers themselves and with our several fair trade, our national fair trade organizations, such as the Fair Trade Foundation in the UK, to really take the pulse of what's most important, what are the priorities, and how can we help you meet those goals. I'm happy to say that the coffee strategy, after a grueling period of 10 months, was just approved yesterday by our fair trade executive team. So now we will start with some of the implementation of that strategy. And within the coffee strategy itself, we have developed several new approaches toward producer empowerment, especially under the growth and innovation section. We've developed a new program that we're calling South to South, which is really trying to promote the use of fair trade products in producing countries themselves rather than just exporting them to consuming countries. And we're starting something new later this year called the Fair Trade Coffee School. For many years, we would do individual workshops, regional workshops that would focus on price risk management, quality improvement, best agricultural practices, things like that. And they were limited in scope, and I think they didn't have the reach that we were really looking for. And so we are partnering with an online platform to develop a series of classes that will be available to all of the small producer organizations simultaneously. It's an interactive set of classes, so participants can ask questions, they can be tested on how well they're understanding the information being provided, and it also acts as a way for us to continually improve the information that we're providing. Another innovative project that we're working on that will be started in 2022 is something that we're called Next Gen. As everybody knows, the next generation of potential coffee farmers, the children of current coffee farmers, they've had a much wider window on the world than their parents or grandparents did due to increased access to technology, the internet, DVDs, a variety of different media platforms, and also increased access to education. And for many of them, they see coffee farming as more or less the lowest rung on the ladder of economic opportunity. And we're starting to see more and more of a youth migration into urban centers, so that, you know, the idea is that I would rather sell phone cards than become a coffee farmer. And so what we're trying to do is increase the capacity and the knowledge base of youth in communities through a public-private scholarship program that will involve working directly with the governments of producing countries to provide scholarships to either universities or technical schools for members of the youth population who have demonstrated a certain aptitude, whether it's in community organizing, agricultural practices, financial literacy, any number of different skill sets, that they would be provided with a scholarship to either a technical school or a university to pursue a course of study, following which they would return to the cooperative setting for a prescribed period of time, an agreed upon period of time, to really put the skill sets that they have recently acquired into real world practice, and thereby also increasing the knowledge base and the capacity of the small producer organizations themselves. Following that agreed upon period, then they're either free to go pursue another career path or to stay within the cooperative. And this would be a continuing program. It's sort of based around the idea of the US Peace Corps. We are also going to be reaching out to commercial partners, because we've had a lot of people and companies saying that they would like to increase their impact within the fair trade supply chain. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be purchasing more certified coffee, but they would like to have more interaction and connection with these producer communities. So we realize that beyond the scholarship, students will also be required to have some sort of living expenses. And so we would ask for sponsorship from these commercial partners. In terms of advocacy and engagement, many of you know that we've been working for several years on a living income model, really trying to identify what the baselines are to achieve a living income in various regions around the world. The $1.40 fair trade minimum price was set as an average price of the cost of sustainable production across all of our producer networks. And that was set several years ago. And we realized that this has to be revised, and we're going through a cost of sustainable production study in collaboration with the people in our own organization that are running the living income work. And the living income work is really taking different elements of a producer's life, whether it's, I guess it's going to be difficult for me to encapsulize here, but basically it's a model that takes into consideration a farmer's size of his land, his or her land, what the ideal or what the maximum yield could be if all elements were magically in place, what kind of support they would be required from their producer organizations, what kind of off-farm outcome they're earning, and what it takes to really provide a decent standard of living that includes decent housing, access to food year-round, medical care and education, and a little bit extra in case of emergencies. And this is going to be different in each region. And so we're benchmarking this in 10 different countries this year and into next year, and then being able to develop what we call fair trade living income reference prices. We're pretty far along in Colombia right now, Indonesia, and the work in Uganda is continuing, and we'll continue to roll out those prices and this work over the next few years. Obviously, once we set these living income reference prices, it's really up to both the industry and governments to embrace them and to really be able to actualize them and put them into practice. Finally, over in digitization, I think everybody realizes that transparency and traceability are sort of the main tenets of sustainability these days. And Fairtrade is developing a series of new platforms for delivering these timely impact reports and data regarding supply chain dynamics and trends. But because we are really focused on producer empowerment, we don't want this to be another form of extraction from producing countries. We firmly believe that all data is owned by the producers themselves, and we want to make sure that they can both access the information, take ownership of it, and benefit from it. So it's been a little bit of a slower process than a usual top-down approach, but we expect to have these platforms, these interactive platforms in place later this year and the beginning of next year. So I think finally, when we're considering sustainability strategies, I think for all of us, one of the major considerations is cost. But as an industry, we really need to consider what the price will be if we don't invest in sustainability of our entire supply chain. And I think one of the things that's been challenging for me personally is back in the 1980s and 1990s, when we started talking about farmer sustainability and sustainable supply chains, we were really looking at producers themselves identifying what their biggest challenges were and what could help them achieve sustainable livelihoods and also increase the quality of their coffee, which would result in higher prices. And we did everything to support those efforts. And now I think we're starting to see more of a shift where the burden of sustainability and creating sustainable supply chains is really placed on the shoulders of producers themselves. And combined with low prices and all of the challenges which we've just identified through climate change and price volatility and COVID-19, they're in a position, they're probably the link in the supply chain that is least equipped and has the least resources to really take on a lot of extra work in terms of meeting sustainability goals that are set by companies. And so I think that when we're looking at sustainable supply chains, we have to look at the entire supply chain, what it takes to transport coffee, what our packaging costs are, what our roasting costs are in terms of carbon footprint, and really take that into an assessment and make farmers be part of that system toward addressing these challenges rather than just the sole parties responsible for it. So I think that in the last 30 years or so, and certainly in the last 20 years, we've come to realize that sustainability is no longer just an ethical concern, but it presents some really existential questions regarding our current business models and the future of coffee going forward. And I think that we have the opportunity now, we're at an inflection point, to really make some decisions that can help to influence the direction of coffee in a positive direction in the near future and into the next generation. Thanks.
And that was Peter Kettler, who is the Global Coffee Manager at Fair Trade. And he was sharing there how the organization he works for is working towards a better future for coffee and obviously for Fair Trade coffee. So thanks for listening. We're basically out of time. Hope you have a good rest of your day. And we're going to leave you with some music. But before we do that, you can always email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca with comments or suggestions. And you can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/equilibriumckutmontreal. You can find us at our little website, which is equilibriumradio.weebly.com. And we have an affiliated podcast on Spotify, which you can find by looking for the Equilibrium Radio Podcast. So thanks for listening. We're going to leave you with some music now. Here is I Couldn't Believe My Eyes by Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry from their album A Long Way From Home.
Just a little while ago, couldn't believe my eyes. It was just a little while ago, you know, I was really surprised. Walked in a place the other day, I couldn't believe my eyes. The fridge of dad was in the wrong room, boys, his eyes surprised. Walked on in to another room, I couldn't believe my eyes. Sleeping on the stove, dog laying on the table. All the food in that house didn't even have a label. Went on in two other rooms, I couldn't believe my eyes. What I found going on in there, you know I was really surprised. Hats and coats all over the floors, chairs hanging on the wall. Sight that I'd ever seen, a canary playing with a ball.
Wait a minute, that's too fast.
Now what?
Kick it over here, baby pop!
CKUT, yo, yo, this is for your mind, soul, and spirit. Plus your positive vibes, masters at work, you gotta hear it. And West Indian rhythms on Saturday night. Roots, rock, reggae, I keep it tight. Manchild, hitting switches, keep it right. The cypher on a Friday, Psalms of soul, I do it my way. With ill groove on Sunday, I gotta say one way. We stick together, it's for unity in the community. On CKUT at 90.3, Manchild and John Fish. We give you that musical wish to put more music in that dish. So listen to your radio station and simply turn it on. CKUT, word is born, word is born. Y'all enjoy yourselves, love you Montreal. Tune in to CKUT, always.
Tutu twang, this is why we are.